Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Welcome back to today's Football Times, the podcast that tries to make sense of the modern game. In today's episode, we kick off with a review of the summer transfer window, exploring the biggest signings, clubs' financial strategies, and the exciting impact of new profit and sustainability rules. Then we dive into a new Champions League format, unpacking what it means for Europe's top teams and how it will shape the future of the tournament. Joining me are two members of the TFT crew with modern as their middle name. Welcome Dave Bowler and Stephen Scragg. Dave, you must be ready for a discussion about PSR, FFP, Champions League formats.
Yes, I'm looking forward to learning about it because it's all Greek to me. If I had modern as my middle name, I've changed it by deed poll, I can tell you.
And Stephen, do you think you'll be penning a book about a league format where you don't actually play all the teams in the league?
Can't quite see it myself. I do like the I don't know, the sense of, is it Schadenfreude? I'm the Germans, terrible Schadenfreude, that's a, you know, the generation that took my European Cup and put a different hat on it are now complaining about the next generation's new hat on what they had throughout the, you know, the last, what, 30 odd years, I suppose it is. But no, that's someone else's book to be right. Absolutely.
So we're going to try and chat through some issues that are arising in modern football and chewing the fat, if you like, over some of these issues on These Football Times. So we're going to start off with thoroughly incomprehensible review of the transfer window of 24-25 this summer and try and make sense of what on earth clubs are doing, how they're trying to meet these financial rules. So I'm going to talk about Newcastle and Nottingham Forest. So Newcastle decided that selling Elliot Anderson for about £30 million is a really good young prospect at Newcastle, probably would have got some first team minutes for them. Decided to sell him to Nottingham Forest, who are obviously trying to sign every single player possible to make sense of staying in the Premier League. But as a trade-off, they sold Newcastle a Greek goalkeeper for £20 million, who's probably barely ever going to play. Dave, does this deal, or these deals, kind of sum up everybody's confusion about transfers at the moment, what it means to meet PSR regulations, what even are the regulations, and how do we, sort of as football fans, make sense of what our clubs can do and fit into in this new system?
It is very, very strange, the whole thing. I mean, now, you know, in days gone past, and I'm only talking sort of 10 years ago, transfer windows were all about accumulating footballers, trying to, you know, improve your squad, improve your team. And that was really the only criteria, and how much money had you got. I mean, even if you go down as lowly a position as the Albion in the Championship, who, you know, new ownership, got rid of the Chinese owners, everybody's thrilled. And the first thing they have to do is start flogging off some players to try and meet the PSR regulations that the previous owners had knackered. Now, obviously, Newcastle are doing something similar on a far grander scale, obviously. But when it comes to you know, us as supporters having to know the ins and outs of financial fair play and PSR and all of that, it does suck the joy out of the whole thing. I've got a great deal of sympathy with the levelling the playing field idea. You know, I'm all in favour of that. And I'm also in favour of the financial sustainability, because nobody wants clubs going to the wall and, you know, Bury and stuff a few years ago. Nobody wants any of that either. But none of the rules that have come in seem to actually do anything to make any of that happen. You know, I mean, Manchester City are still a million miles ahead of everybody. Newcastle have been taken over by the Saudis and can't begin to catch them up because they have to worry about having goalkeepers from Nottingham Forest that nobody's ever, you know, nobody's ever going to hear of ever again. Manchester City seemingly are untouchable. And where does that make any sense? I don't get it. And now, you know, we're talking about even today, they're talking about the independent football regulator in this country, and UEFA have jumped up and down saying, well, you have one of them and we might not let you play in the Euros. which is handy given that we're hosting them. I'm not sure how that's going to work. The whole game has become too complicated, hasn't it? Really, with the finances, I genuinely don't know what methodology you can bring into this to make it work anymore. You can't blame clubs for being ambitious and wanting to spend money and catch up. But yeah, when you then have to get to the point where, okay, we've brought a player through the ranks from the age of seven, right, we'll sell him because he's pure profit. I mean, that takes a lot away from the game because everybody wants to see in their team somebody who's come through the ranks. You know, that's always adds a bit to it. You know, he's one of our own chant, all that sort of stuff. That now seems to be even less likely because those kids, you're now going to stuff them into your youth academy so that you know that you can use them in 10 years' time to fix your PSR or your financial fair play problems. It's bizarre. I don't get it. I really don't get it. And, you know, I think it's one of those unintended consequences things. I don't think this was what people thought when they brought in financial fair play and PSR. I think that there was a genuine move to try and level things up, and it hasn't worked. We're going to have to go back to square one, I think.
I think that's the problem, isn't it? Especially if you're in the Premier League, you're going to hoover up young talent. So, you know, I don't want to say like the old days, but like in the past where you may have one star in your academy if you're in League One or the Championship and you could sell them for a big profit and then actually reinvest it in your club, whether it's your facilities, your academy, it's kind of disappeared or it will disappear. And I think a lot of these deals are basically just trying to balance out the fact that they want one player, but actually it helps the other club out as well. It's almost a little bit of collusion on the club's behalf, isn't it? Stephen, some of these sort of trading deals, if you like, or these swap deals were kind of quite common in the summer. Do you think, as Dave says, it is that sort of unintended consequence of, I'm not going to say punishing clubs for having a good homegrown player that can make money off, but maybe trying to get further up the table by buying better players. They've got to sell, actually, these players who are now just pure profit.
Commodities. You know, I think it comes down to it's moving, I don't know, it's digits from one column to another, almost. I mean, go into kind of like what Manchester City will be getting up to this week. You know, it's almost like a lot of clubs probably have bigger squads of solicitors than they do football players, which would take some doing to start with. But yeah, as far as kind of like the oddities in transfers, I mean, in some ways, we're only just catching up to the way things have been done in, you know, other major leagues across Europe and, you know, South America. You know, the concept of a player being owned by two different clubs, you know, the concept of a player being half owned by a club and half owned by, you know, the agent, you know, going back to kind of like the Mascherano and Tevez saga to West Ham and all that type of stuff. I can remember, was it Samuel Eto'o being half owned by Real Madrid and Real Mallorca? You know, Real Madrid didn't want him to go to Barcelona. The player himself didn't want to, you know, leave Spanish football in La Liga. And, you know, it was, you know, we looked at it all askance, you know, at the time, you know, 20 odd years ago. But it's bit by bit crept up on us. But it's had that extra bit of shade and shadow by the fact that, you know, we have so much foreign ownership now. And there is that, I don't know, that I suppose mistrust. You know, what are the intentions of these owners of these football clubs, you know, when push comes to shove? And, you know, they've, so many of these owners have come in and changed the way the clubs have operated. In many respects, some in good ways. No, don't get me wrong. Some in very good ways. Some in, you know, not so great ways. But yeah, you know. So to us, the supporters, it's all very, I don't know, it's all very unsettling. It's, you know, not what we want to see because, you know, our love of football comes from our inner child basically, and we just want to see the ball in the back of the net and the hero doing it and whatever that. I don't know, whatever that target you have dreamt of for this season, whether it's survival in a certain division, if it's winning a European trophy, winning a division promotion, a cup run, whatever that is, you know, just survival maybe, it subtracts from that. You know, it becomes Dallas and Dynasty. You know, it's just, you know, a completely different thing. And it's unedifying in that respect.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, isn't it? And I suppose maybe it's got to the point where it's the only way that you can preserve your club for your fans. Because if you fall foul of the rules, you're going to get points deductions, fines. It may be that you got to sell even more players to kind of meet the requirements, which means you end up falling further down the league. It's kind of that double-edged sword, isn't it?
You've got that alteration. They never seem to quite know UEFA, FIFA. You know, they never quite seem to be able to get it right. They themselves don't seem to know which direction they need to turn in to set some scriptures down in stone rather than in sand, just to see the tide come in and wash all the rules away again, which is what we currently have. And it is. So much of it, you know, it's just so entrenched within the game now that you can't unpick it. You know, you have specialist journalists who go into kind of like, you know, they've made careers out of kind of like covering the financial side of the game. It's mad. I mean, I can remember being shortlisted for Blogger of the Year at the FSF Awards back in, I don't know, 2018, something like 2017 or so. And the winner was not someone who wrote about football on the pitch. It was someone who wrote about football finance. You know, I was the shed seven of the scene. I was there just taking the free meal. Never going to pick up the award. But yeah, it was interesting to see. You know, and it's just it's here to stay. That's the thing. It's here to stay. And within that, you know, I think we always used to say, well, it's just the upper echelon of the game. And it's not the case anymore. You know, it's permeating through, you know, lower divisions and into non-league football as well. I mean, it's why, you know, I think we find, just when football is stripped down to its basic bones, that you know, we all ooh and ah at that magical piece of skill or that impudent goal that's scored. And I think we were taken for a ride in that respect, because, you know, we as the, for I hate to say it, the paying customers. You know, we are hooked on the basis of what's done with the ball, you know, and the owners, the rule makers, they know that, you know, without a shadow of a doubt.
Does it just need blowing up again and make it all the Wild West?
It probably does, but, you know, in many respects, it is the Wild West. It's you know, it's wilder than it ever has been. I mean, you look at, say, F1, and there's a, you know, you can watch a race, someone wins, you see them spray the champagne all over the podium, and then you kind of read 24 hours later that they've been, been disqualified, and it's kind of like, actually, they're not the winner. Are we going to get to that with football? You know, is that what's going to go on this year? Manchester City spraying the champagne, and then, you know, the title is later handed to, you know, A, B, or C, who are going to come trailing in 17 points behind in second place.
I suppose that's the big question, isn't it? I think the Man City shenanigans probably hang over quite a lot of this for a lot of clubs, especially at the top end of the league. And there's probably quite a lot of clubs who don't care. Yeah, Man City have spent all this money. They've got 115 charges. It's kind of a bit of a social media storm, I think, for a lot. But do League Two clubs care what happens to Man City? Does it have an impact on them? Do they care if, you know, you're trying to come out the National League and your name's Wrexham and you've got a couple of Hollywood owners spending a lot of money? Where is the focus? Is it on all these clubs who are spending money? Because I think we probably all want to be near the top end of the league and we all want to have a chance to get there. But Dave, is it something that's just completely out of smaller clubs, in inverted commas, hands? You know, is it actually helping the bigger clubs who are already there to maintain their position? Is that what is underpinning all of this more than actually trying to stop the berries and people like that actually going out of business?
I think it is. I mean, again, I'm not sure that was necessarily the intention. I remember when I was still at the helm, when all this financial fair play started to come in, and our chairman, Jeremy Peace, went down to the meeting where they voted for it and all that stuff, and he voted against it. Now, Albion being a club with, you know, no money and bumping around the bottom six of the division, you'd think we'd be quite keen on that kind of stuff. Of course, he got his eyes on, I want to sell this football club and I want to sell it to somebody who can then spend wagon loads of money to bring us up to the level of Liverpool and Manchester City. And if we have financial fair play, we can't, which is what Newcastle are finding now. So, I mean, I think it was done with the right motives, which is unusual for football, but I think there was, you know, some sort of right thinking, in inverted commas. But it's putting the genie back in the bottle. And I mean, now football has always been about spending money. You know, Manchester United spent money in the 50s, Liverpool spent money in the 70s, Manchester United and Chelsea and Blackburn spent, you know, that's what happens with football. That's always been the case. The difference now is the magnitude and the difference, you know, the gap between the richest and the rest. And, you know, I mean, you were saying before we came on air, Rob, you know, talking about Chelsea making things work out by selling a hotel from one part of the group to another part of the group. Now, that might get you around the fair play rules, and it might get you, I mean, I don't know what that's got to do with football. And surely, B, that's against the spirit of the whole thing. And, you know, Manchester City having their various sponsorships of the various shirts and training grounds and stadiums and God knows what else. Nobody's going to say that that's necessarily market value that they've got. But, you know, they're paid off the top. Birmingham City, St Andrews at Knighthead Park, you know, I mean, that's, I guess Birmingham City at the minute would struggle to sell sponsorship of St Andrews to anybody other than their own owners. But if the owners have got money, well, at the same time, what's the problem with that? Because without that, you are going to have that top four or five that's always there forevermore, and there'll be no movement. It's whichever way you come at this, whatever, you know, even if you have those right intentions, even if you do want to level the playing field, the way that you get there is just so blocked by big money, clever accountancy, shrewd solicitors, and all of that sort of stuff that it's very difficult to see how you, you know, as Stephen says, how you unpick all of this now and try and start again. Because I don't know how it is. You know, if you've got sovereign nation states owning football clubs, you know, how do you get around that? I don't see how we do it anymore.
I think there's also quite a lot of disparity at all the different levels in English professional football as well. You've got the, what is it, 110 million over 3 years in the Premiership. I think it's 39 million over 3 years in the Championship. League One, I think you're allowed to spend 65% of your income on wages with unlimited transfer spends, which is why Birmingham have been able to sign Jay Stansfield for more than some Premier League teams have spent net. From what you hear from certain League Two owners, they have to have their budget approved before the season starts in League Two and prove that they've got the cash to pay that, whether it's 2 million or 3 million or whatever. So the fact that all four leagues have got a slightly different system kind of just doesn't make any sense. I follow the NBA quite a lot and have done for quite a long time. And they've obviously got salary cap rules that is based on TV income. So let's say that the TV income is, I don't know, whatever it is, 10 billion. The players will get 49% of that allocated to salaries. So it means you get a minimum salary if you've been playing for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 15. You're only allowed a maximum salary in a certain club, which I think is like 35% of the total amount. So if it was 200 million quid, you can take 35% of that. If you're with the team who you've been with since you started, you might be able to have 40% of the salary cap. So you can actually take on more salary because you're staying, you know, promoting loyalty. But it still doesn't mean that clubs haven't spent, or teams haven't spent twice the amount of the salary cap, because they have to pay taxes and all sorts of stuff. The only thing that I thought was interesting about a model like that is that there's a hard cap, which is normally like 120% or 130% of the regular cap. But then every dollar over that, you have to then pay into a pot, which gets shared out between everybody else who's actually under the cap. So effectively, you are putting the money back, almost back into the pyramid, if you like. And that's, for me, that's probably the only way they could try and readdress some of the balance. You know, those teams who are going over the PSR, find them and give it to the EFL. You know, that's where the money goes. Because where does this money go? You know, if Man City get a £100 million fine, where's it going to go? Is it going to the Premier League to write a new white paper on how the transfer money should be spent? Or could it actually be spent in grassroots academies, you know, some non-league football or whatever? I suppose for me, that's the thing.
Lowering the price of tickets would be good.
Well, there you go. I mean, you could even give subsidies for anyone, any fans who've got, I mean, some of the things that you see about revenue increasing sort of the parking prices of disabled parking at some of the biggest clubs in the league. because not enough people are using it, so we need to make more money from it so we get the income. I mean, really? We're basing our transfer dealings on, can we get another 100 quid per game from those pesky parking meters? You can just imagine, can't you, the chairman or the CEO of a football club with the two P's, you know, dropping out of the parking meter to see if they can spend another couple of £1,000 a week. I mean, it's just, it's pretty ridiculous. I think some of the things I suppose we probably should talk about is some of the things that they're trying to do to solve this problem, which probably can't be solved. And they've talked about squad cost, which is, this is again where it all starts getting a bit messy. In the Champions League this year, your squad cost has to be a percentage of your revenue, which is your all your income, plus your transfer sales and all that kind of stuff all put together. I think it's like 85% in the first year, dropping down to 70% or something. But obviously, if you earn £750 million a year in income, real or fake, depending on which side of Manchester you're on, your squad is going to be well below that anyway. And most of the, I think, apart from Chelsea, are underneath that. So the other one that they're possibly going to try in the Premier League, and have a think about how this would work, is that it's like squad cost anchoring. So basically, you look at who's made the least amount of money in the league, which I think was like Southampton made like 150 million or something like that. And basically every team would effectively be able to spend like double that amount of money every season. Stephen, shall we let every team spend £300 million every season in the Premier League and not create any more of a gap between that and the EFL?
It'd be interesting to see what Chelsea could do with that.
Sign one player.
That's the type of money that they spend on the tea lady and in the kit washing and all that type of stuff. Yeah, again, there'll always be someone with that intricate vision to be able to pick their way around the loopholes of all this. Said it slightly tongue in cheek earlier on about football clubs having a bigger squad of solicitors than players, but there's a lot of truth in that. It's a bit like Adrian Newey in F1's just been signed up by Aston Martin on wages that were more than the accumulated wages of about 17 of the drivers for next year, because he knows how to get around all of these the way things are, the new rules that are brought out, the new regulations, and this is what the football clubs do. They have intelligent people working the way around the rules and be able to pick out the loopholes, because push comes to shove, these people tend to be cleverer than the ones who are coming up with the bright ideas. And sport in itself is, it's just the nature of it, because it's all about one-upmanship. It's a competitive arena, and teams, players, individuals, they all want to be better than everyone else, and to find whatever way around doing that is possible. You can only look at, kind of like the Olympics, and we're never far away from a drug bust. Lance Armstrong on a bike. You'd think getting a bike and just having a race on a bike would be one of the most natural things in the world, the simplest thing. No, there has to be something enhancing it. So it's just within the very fabric of sport, to win, and win at all costs. That's the way it comes. And it'll forever be that. You cannot change that. That is just the way sport is, for a lot of people. We'd all love a level playing field in everything, but has there ever been a level playing field? In many respects, we can talk about kind of like players being signed. You can go back 100 years to the likes of Tommy Lawton. Who drops down two divisions to play for, you are the, that year, it's Haaland dropping down to play, for Wigan Athletic, because, they'll give him a pretend job to make up, an extra bit of money because they've brought in maximum wage. It's just the way. I mean, sport in itself, not just football, but it's an extension of human nature. There's that nature of wanting better all the time, and wanting better than your neighbour or whatever that is. We need to beat them. There's always a bogeyman. There's always, a rival in some description. There's always them. Whatever it is, politics, working environments, there is always, the woman or the man or the team or, whatever it is. And sport just amplifies that. And there will forever be someone with a, you know, that idea and that vision to be able to break through whatever barriers are put up, and that'll never change.
I mean, the irony is, I mean, based on what you've just been saying, Stephen, the irony is that the best thing that happened to Birmingham City is getting relegated into League One. Because if they'd stayed in the Championship, they would have been under different rules. Whether Birmingham City have brought the right players to get into the Premier League and compete in the Premier League is another story. But essentially, by going down to League One, they've been able to do 2 years' worth of transfer business in one fell swoop because they've got the money. You would fancy them to win.
They've got people there that spot this and say this is the opportunity. It's all about identifying and seizing the opportunity. And you know, that's what Birmingham City are clearly doing.
Because in doing that, I mean, you know, the rules that you mentioned a few minutes ago, Rob, the amount that you can spend going up from the Championship into the Premier League isn't enough, essentially. So if you can do some of your spending while you're in League One, which sounds absolutely bizarre, but you know that's the way around, that's the loophole, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we've got Borough fans who will say it'd be really good if we were just a yo-yo club for about 6 years, keep going up and down, we can cash the Premier League money in, and by that time we'll have a squad. And you think that's absolutely never going to happen. You can never bank on. I mean, as a fan of a club in the Championship who's been swimming around in the swamp that is the Championship for far too long, since 2009, it doesn't happen. You've just got to try and build the best squad that you can with the money you've got. And if you get up, you try and be as sensible as possible. All that we do maybe need to think about, I suppose, is Middlesbrough as a football club loses £20 million a year. £20 million just to exist. Like, that is the thing that is crazy. To be fair, we never really had like a director of football or a director of sport or that kind of thing until the last couple of years. And actually, we still lose 20 million a year, but we sell enough players for it not to matter on the balance sheet. So now that minus 20 becomes like minus 4 because we sold Tube Rakpo and Morgan Rogers for a decent bit of money. So now it only says minus 4 or minus 5. So when we're only allowed minus 39 over the 3 years, we're actually okay. And that's the thing that sort of gets you a little bit, that if you've got some smart people, like Liverpool have, somehow selling every single player for double what they're worth, no matter whether they've played a first-team game at Anfield or not, like how they've got £50 million for Fabio Carvalho and Sepp Vandenberg, nobody will ever know. Talk about financial doping. Never mind Man City. I'd be putting Liverpool's transfer committee and data analysis up in front of the court. So I don't know what they do in these transfer negotiations. I think at one point they had a cash line, a credit line to Bournemouth, whether they were sort of money laundering down there. But was it Adam Smith, who no one had heard of and heard of since? I think Solanke went down there,
Solanke,
didn't he? Sorry, Brad Smith, wasn't it?
Yeah, Jordan Ibe. Yeah, Jordan Ibe.
Honestly, a little credit line. It was like Bournemouth Bank. But
it was.
It is that thing of, have you got the smartest people in the room? I think what's happening now with football, like Aston Villa got Monchu, who obviously is really famous for being at Sevilla and winning loads of trophies, which actually is brilliant because he's using his smarts to win things. And as long as clubs are doing that, I suppose you can't really fault them, you know, whether they're classed as like a cup team or whatever, but he's kind of trying to meander around that. But anyway, I'm sure we'll come back to this in January when we're all enjoying a winter transfer deadline. But speaking of Aston Villa, they've decided that Champions League football is now worth anywhere up to £100 a game for a fan to watch exactly the same set of their players against another set of players. So we're going to talk a little bit for the last little segment about this new Champions League format. So obviously, after football was invented in 1992, the Champions League came along with a group stage to give the biggest clubs even more. You see the theme going on here. The biggest clubs got even more money from more games, or more guaranteed games, shall we say. We even had a double group phase at the end of the 90s, early noughties, that basically everybody realised was a really silly idea and they got rid of. I don't know if anybody's actually thought that they wanted more Champions League games. I mean, I watch quite a bit of football, quite happy to miss half the group games, to be honest, and wait until we get some really good knockout games. And we've probably had some quite good ones during the last few years. But now we've got this league format that's come into place. Dave, we've got a league where we don't play everybody. We've got a league where we've got a guaranteed amount of games, but we don't play the same teams home and away. I had to explain this to my dad when the draw was on. He was like, what is going on here? How can they play 16 games? I was like, no, Dad, they're playing 4 home and 4 away. And he's kind of thinking, That's not football. That's not what you do in Europe. Even when you had two legs, he talks about the Leeds team of the 70s and all that's like his era and watching a bit of Liverpool in the 80s. Even when you had two legs, you were home and away. You know, it's only the FA Cup where you don't play both legs. So how do we make sense, Dave, of this new format?
Well, you don't really in any sporting context. I mean, you know, that was always supposedly the idea of the Champions League. Although, as you say, it was to make sure that Bayern Munich didn't get knocked out in the first round accidentally. I mean, that was the point. But the idea was that you played in a group format, you played home and away, and therefore the better team would eventually come out to the top, and they would then go into the knockout stages, and yeah, we would get the best team in Europe at the end of it. There's no way on earth that you can say that that is what's going to be delivered by this new format, because for all the seeding and for all of that, that does introduce a lot more luck of the draw, which I'm actually in favour of. Because, you know, as you said, Rob, you know, however much football you watch, the Champions League group games are basically pretty much avoidable. The Champions League is a waste of time up until Christmas, because in the past, you know, you could look at the eight groups and you would get, of the 16 teams that went through, we would all get about 14 of them right. No problem at all. And, you know, there's always a couple that, you know, perhaps are outliers. But it's become tedious and predictable, and I presume what's really happened is that the TV viewing figures have collapsed, which is why they've got to try and liven it all up with a new format. And I'm not actually against the new format, because it does offer you the chance to play a wider number of teams. You know, if you've ever watched the Scottish Premier League and you play the same team four times in the season, you know how boring that gets. And you know, I suppose you get out of that from the Champions League. It'll be interesting to see how in practice it works out, and whether all of the obvious suspects come out as the top eight that you would imagine will or not, or whether it does mix it up a bit. If it does mix it up a bit, I imagine that they'll be immediately changing it back to the old format to make sure that Bayern Munich and Manchester City and Real Madrid all do get through after all. So that will be the interesting thing. It's a very convoluted setup, but I think, you know, basically the Champions League as the Champions League is a failure up until when you get to the last 16, and then it starts to become interesting, which is why they should never have mucked about with the European Cup in the first place. That is, of course, another story. But, yeah, why not do something to try and shake it up a bit? And again, I'm hopeful that this might be some unintended consequences this year, and we might get a few unlikely teams qualifying, which would be nice.
My thought was on this. They should have gone back to the original Champions League format, where it was knockout and then the last eight go into a league. So you may get a few outliers who, you know, go through on away goals or knock out a Liverpool or a Man United or a Bayern Munich or whoever's in it. And then you've got the top eight in two groups of four, and you might actually get some really decent games later on. But I mean, there's probably a million other formats that could have happened. And remember that they're doing this whole league to get rid of eight teams. So it's only the bottom eight that actually disappear from the Champions League. And the rest of them then go into a knockout situation to join the top eight, who aren't really the top eight. They're just the top eight based on the teams they played from their sort of selection of fixtures. One thing was quite good though, Stephen, is the draw went off without a hitch, apart from, you know, maybe a few people not reading the right team names. But God bless AI for at least getting the fixtures right.
Yeah, fair play to AI there. I didn't even realise it was just eight that we're going. I thought it was 12 that we lost, but eight's even worse. But is it 288 games to lose a small handful of teams?
It's something like that.
Whether it's 8 or 12 that get knocked out at that stage, I mean, it's
it is 12. Yeah, you're right.
It's 12. Yeah, but I mean, even so, I mean, 288 games to eliminate 12 teams is absolute lunacy. And, you know, I've only taken a look at the format as such. I knew it was eight games and all that type of stuff. And, you know, even as someone who will be going to the games that take place at Anfield and as a team with vested interest in it, you know, I didn't even, you know, have a full grasp on the format until about half an hour ago after I agreed to take part in this podcast. That shows how interested that even I am, you know, in something my own team is playing in. Yeah, it's sure to be unwieldy. There's sure to be, you know, massive flaws in it. It reminds me a little bit of when they brought in the group stages to the UEFA Cup come Europa League. And was it groups of five where you played the teams, was it four games or something like that? But you ended up playing two at home, two away, didn't you? And you weren't playing everyone home and away, and it was was it three teams going through? UEFA just keep on finding this, you know, this I don't know, route to an unsatisfactory format. But within that, and the same as Dave, I'm not averse to change, you know, at all. But you know, it needs, again, it's that concept of, is it, you know, when more is less, you know, becomes less, then that's where it becomes a sticking point for me. You know, we had a lot of football in the group stages anyway, and we were all starting to fall asleep during it. So the answer to that is to have even more games in the group stages to play. It seems kind of a bit battlefront to me. You know, I'm sure we'll come on to it in international terms at some point. And certainly everyone in this chat room knows my thoughts on the Nations League, for instance. Again, it's that concept of more is less. You know, you've got Arsene Wenger suggesting that the World Cup should be every 2 years. Come on. You know, it's there must be someone out there who there'll be a kid somewhere with a really bright idea who'll have it absolutely nailed. Who could do it? There'll be a 12-year-old out there who can do this better than UEFA can.
If you are that 12-year-old child, please do get in touch with the podcast, because we'd quite like to put our input. Wait till we need to, eventually, we're going to try and talk about a different kind of issue in modern football as the season goes on. I can't wait till we get to the Club World Cup edition and we work out that the winners of the Champions League from 4 years ago is going to get a prime seat on the plane to where the USA for another tournament in the summer that none of us actually really want. It's funny you talk about that year, the UEFA Cup that went into the Europa League. That was the first season, that was 2004-2005, which was Middlesbrough's first season ever in Europe. Then the following season, when we got to the final, I think we got to the semi-finals of the FA Cup that year as well. I think we played 62 games, 61 or 62 games across it. I think Fulham did something similar maybe a couple of years later. And to be honest, I don't even know if I want to watch Borough for 60-plus games, because you know that 10 or 20 of them, you're going to be playing, you know, five or six of the kids, because you've had a game on the Thursday night where you've played your Viducas and your Hasselbanks and whoever, and then you play some kind of 19-year-old kids the weekend, and your manager ends up getting a season ticket thrown at him because you've forgotten about the league. And I think there's so much football within that maybe it is linked to what we talked about before about transfers. You know, these clubs do need do they actually need them? 20, 25, 30, 35 players if they can call on at any one time. And it ends up hoovering and hoarding talent in certain areas of certain clubs and stuff because they're going to play so many games.
It is that imbalance again, though, isn't it? You know, if you are in Europe and you do quite well, you are playing far too many games. Equally, Ipswich could play 40 games this season. They were knocked out of the League Cup at the first attempt. If they got knocked out of the third round of the FA Cup, they'll play 40 games. That's not enough games, is it? In the wider scheme of things, there's got, you know, this whole business about players playing too much football and all of that. There's got to come some balancing point. That, you know, Chelsea have left Cole Palmer at the Conference League squad, and that maybe that's going to be the thing. A player can only be registered for three competitions in a year. He can't play in all four. Or something like that, I don't know. Or a player can only play 40, 45 games a season or something to deal with those demands. There's got to be some kind of regulation on that, I think. But equally, you know, when we talk about, oh, we can't have FA Cup replays because we play too much football. You're not playing too much football if you're Bournemouth. You're playing 40 games, maybe 41.
I mean, I've said it a fair few times, is that clubs should be restricted on how many competitions they play. You know, teams who qualify for Europe shouldn't be playing the League Cup, for instance, but that doesn't mean that the detriment of the League Cup, where it loses its European qualification place. It's just that you've attained that position, and you know, what you've got is this constantly expanding European competitions being thrown against a landscape that was set out kind of like 70 odd years ago after the birth of the League Cup. You know, so in terms of English football, you have, you know, had a 42 game top flight. Then you'd have the FA Cup with its unlimited replays. Then you would have the League Cup, which also had unlimited replays. You know, two-legged second round games, two-legged semi-finals, and all of that. But European competition was kind of like quite streamlined. And then obviously the, you know, European games. You know, it was an odd friendly here and there. and your qualifying groups were much smaller because Europe had yet to kind of like properly proliferate, and you know, and all the satellite states had gained independence from the respective communist motherships. But it was kind of like self-regulating in that respect. But the more that football expands, you know, there's got to be a breaking point to, you know, that there has to be a breaking point to, whether that's streamlined top flights. You know, there's a limit on the number of clubs in domestic top divisions of 18 teams or something like that. So it reduces that amount of games. You know, in a way that would give a nice bit of peril in the top flight for a lot of clubs as well. You know, I always remember being love Serie A, you know, for years. You know, went off it when Juventus were winning their 8 or 9 in a row. But it's been, you know, been that little bit more interesting again the last 4 or 5 years. But what was great about Serie A in the 80s and early 90s was it was 18 teams and 4 teams were being relegated. And, you know, but within that, it was less was more. So if we're going for kind of like the concept of more is less, you know, you've got to do some kind of streamlining to it. You know, football has to kind of like be reined back in at some point. In common sense terms, but it's not, because it's never going to be, because money is God, and you know it's a case of more, constantly throw more at it. You know, but you know, for me, yeah, no one club should be playing in any more than 3 competitions in a season.
And I feel for the League Two on that point. I feel for some League Two sides who've got obviously a 46 game league season.
Yeah,
FA Cup. I think they're in round one. I think League Two. That's round one proper. Yeah, then they're in the League Cup. To be fair, the best thing the League Cup ever did was North and South draws for the early stages, because that's just, obviously from a travel point of view, for fans, for the clubs, actually if you reduce the travel, you reduce the cost, etc. And then they've got to do the old LDV vans or Johnson's Paint Trophy or whatever it's going to be called these days. That's another competition that they're in. If you're lucky enough to maybe get in the playoffs, that's another 3 games if you get to Wembley. So you're looking at these clubs, and I think there's a group stage now in that sort of LDV kind of sitting Johnson's Paint. That's a group stage as well, isn't it? What is it actually called? Something Motors, isn't it?
The Bristol Street Motors.
Bristol Street Motors, yeah. I knew it was going to roll off the tongue. But I'm sure that that's got another group stage. Then obviously they were saying, oh yeah, we're going to play all our under-21s and under-23 academy teams because we binned off the reserve league, which was probably fine, that everybody would probably need back again eventually, because so many of these players just don't play any football. I think the point about the registering for certain competitions is quite good. And Stephen, I think the point about the club not registering, maybe it could be the players. So you know, you said the club could only do 3 competitions. Maybe only the players could do 3. So you say, right, you register for the Premier League, the Champions League, and one of the cups. And because these have got massive squads, because they don't register anyone under 21.
Yeah, I think in the upper divisions, Certainly the top flight, that's you know, a great idea. I think it'd be hard to implement for teams lower down the order, whereas I think it would benefit them from playing in a smaller amount of competitions, because let's be honest, a lot of those kind of like the I'm going to call it the Associate Members Cup, because I'm sure it'll have a different sponsorship by the time this podcast ends. It'll be the John West Trophy or something like that. It'll all be, you know, smelling a bit fishy or whatever. But yeah, you know, they play out in front of sparse crowds, and then you get kind of like even the League Cup and the FA Cup. You know, I've sat and watched kind of like an FA Cup quarter final on the television with an half empty ground, and again, it's that kind of like, well, I think as a supporter, you'd appreciate games like that a whole lot more if you didn't have so much football surrounding it as well.
I think that's true, but I also think that the cup games is now because it's the way we consume our football. Because we, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we didn't necessarily have season tickets, did we? We turned up and we paid for every game. And now you have to have your season ticket because you want to have your particular seat because it's an all-seater stadium.
Yeah, and then
you resent paying 20 quid or 30 quid for the cup game, and people stay at home. So I think that's part of it. And you're right about the associate members, Bristol Street Motors, LDV, Johnston Paints, whatever it is. Except when they get to the final, they take 40,000 people within the Wembley.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you've got to get through all that dross to get to the day out that everybody always remembers, and it's a glorious day for the football club. And then that's, you know, that's the other circle that you got to square. I mean, I do think it is, it is something whereby players have got to be raised to the competition. Because we talk about these bloated squads and all of that. But really, if you look at it, most top clubs still only play 16 players, really. And then, a few other blokes will turn up and play 5 minutes as a sop in a league game or whatever. It's the Scott Carson problem. There's Scott Carson. Good luck to him. He's earning an enormous amount of money for not doing anything. Now, I don't know, I've got nothing against him, but that can't be right, can it, either? We've got all these players who are never going to play. Your Greek goalkeeper, they're at Newcastle, taking a lot of money out of the football club, and they don't want to use him under any circumstances. Well, under this sort of system, he's going to play some games.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? And I think maybe the clubs would actually be a little bit more sensible with the money they were spending, because they know they can only play them in certain... I was really surprised at the Cole Palmer thing. Maybe it is protecting him a little bit from a young age. I know that there's quite a lot out there that say that Rooney's always used the example that he played, by the time I think he was 29, he played the same amount of minutes as like the average 35-year-old. I think Raheem Sterling's very similar. Obviously, just got on loan to Arsenal, but I think he's kind of played enough minutes for someone who's like 4 or 5 years older than him, because since the age of what? Steve, was he about 17 when he made his debut for Liverpool, Sterling? 17, 18, wasn't he, I think, around that time?
Yeah, round about that, yeah.
And he's pretty much been a 50-game-a-season man, hasn't he? Near enough, probably for 12 years. So, the mileage on the clock's not getting any easier or better for him. And I think a lot of these issues are tied together as well, aren't they? Because you talk about the TV deal, obviously the new EFL deal, there's 1,000 games on TV, so we need some players to actually be available to play in all those games. But I do remember those European nights with Borough. We've always been around like 25,000 plus for season tickets, like when we were in the Premier League. Then you get like, a few thousand walk-ups to get you to the 30,000. But I remember those European games were 19,000. This is a club who'd never been in Europe. We'd never won a trophy until 2004. And like you say, fans couldn't afford the extra, whatever it was, 100 quid for, the couple of parents and a couple of kids to go to a game. So I think a lot of that is all tied together, isn't it? But for now, on transfer windows and Champions League, I think we'll see how the format goes, and maybe we can sort of review this after the first few rounds of games, which are going to be starting very soon. Similarly with the transfer window, putting that on edge, and we'll see how many games and minutes that Greek goalkeeper's played by the time we come to January or February time. You know what? He'll end up on loan at like some championship club, won't he? And he'll end up being really good, keeping 10 clean sheets and getting him in the playoffs. And you think, why weren't Newcastle playing him? But anyway, that's enough modern football for now. We're going to go back to the old stuff for a bit. But hope you've enjoyed that bit of the chat if you've been listening. Dave and Stephen, I'm sure we could have kept on talking for many an hour on some of these issues. But we're going to try and look at a different issue within the game each week and try and revisit some of them as well on today's football time. So if you have enjoyed the podcast, do your usual, share it with your friends, or keep it to yourself if you want, and you want to listen to it by yourself, that's absolutely fine as well. You'll hear us again on today's football times.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.